Today's podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. I use Zencastr to record the Tally Room podcast, and it's an invaluable tool. I record pretty much every episode of this show remotely, with my guests joining me from wherever they happen to be. Zencastr allows us to record with high-quality sound, even if the internet connection isn't the best. It records a high-quality version on the local desktop and then uploads it when the internet connection allows, meaning that the audio the listeners hear is usually better than what I can hear when I'm recording. It also allows for recording video. I use it to be able to view my guests, but you can also record video in 1080p. It's super easy to use Zencastr. I set up a link for a recording and send it to my guests, and we're getting started in minutes. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code TALLYROOM, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting needs. It's time to share your story. Welcome to the Tally Room Podcast. I'm Ben Rowie. The Solomon Islands went to the polls in April, electing a new parliament, which has now chosen a new prime minister. In today's episode, we'll go through recent politics in the Solomons, the election, and the formation of the new government. My guest today is Karen Baker. Karen is a fellow in the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University with a particular expertise in Pacific Islands politics. Hello, Karen.
Hi, Ben.
This is the first Solomon Islands election since 2019. That last election concluded in Manase Sogavare becoming Prime Minister. Sogavare's Ownership, Unity and Responsibility Party won the most seats in 2024, but it wasn't enough for Sogavare to win another term. Instead, his Foreign Minister, Jeremiah Minnelli, is the new Prime Minister. Karen, there are numerous parties in the Solomon Islands Parliament. What is the role of parties in elections in the Solomons?
So in the election itself, parties don't actually play a huge role. They exist. A lot of candidates do contest as party endorsed, about two-thirds of candidates in this 2024 election. But parties really only come into the fore after the election results have come out. And then we move into this period. It's essentially the election after the election, when the government is formed and the kind of horse trading over who gets to be prime minister starts in earnest. And that's where your party blocks become really important. But for voters themselves in choosing their elected representatives, parties don't actually come into it a huge amount, at least not as much as you might expect.
It does remind me of Papua New Guinea a bit, which is next door, where they also have this kind of culture where there's lots of parties and they are kind of building blocks for coalition government, right, rather than institutions that kind of guides for voters in how they might cast their vote. So is it like PNG in that you do get a lot of candidates who defect between parties as well?
Parties generally kind of act as platforms for potential prime ministerial candidates. So they're very personality-based policy. While they do have policy platforms, there's not often clear differentiations between the outlooks and the ideologies of different parties. And that's quite similar to the PNG context. Another similarity is there have been attempts in both countries to strengthen the political party system in Solomon Islands. You had this Political Parties Integrity Act. You have a Political Parties Commission. And certainly before the election, they were quite active in kind of encouraging voters to vote on policy, to vote for parties rather than independent candidates. But then as we saw from the results, independent candidates actually did quite well in this election.
Let's talk about that, because there were very few sitting independents in the parliament into the election.
So there was one incumbent who contested this election as an independent, but that's one out of the 48 that recontested. So yeah, the vast majority of incumbents were campaigning as party candidates, not necessarily the same party that they won in 2019 under, but as party members, yeah.
But quite a few independents got elected anyway. I believe it was 11.
That's true. 11 independent candidates, including that one incumbent, won their seats. Yeah, so they make up about a fifth of the parliament now.
So would you expect a lot of those independents then to go on to join a party now they're in parliament? Or is there kind of a role to continue as an independent?
I think there are advantages in joining a party or a party bloc after the election if you kind of gravitate towards a particular parliamentary grouping. But there are also some advantages in coming in as an independent. You're a lot more flexible in that period after the election, which has just concluded, when the government is formed. If you're already attached to a party, then you've kind of thrown your cards in with a particular group. But if you're an independent, you can move around.
What sort of voting system are they using in the Solomon Islands?
So Solomon Islands uses first past the post, so very simple. It's been the electoral system since independence in 1978. There has been a bit of debate in recent years about moving perhaps to a preferential voting system, but we still have first past the post for now.
And it's 50 seats in the parliament?
50 seats in the parliament, yeah.
Let's talk about who ended up winning, what formed the coalition government, because effectively the backers of the former prime minister are also the backers of the new prime minister. Thinking about how the coalition process happened, Tsogavare's party, the OUR party, how did they actually do in the election?
They probably expected to do better. They had, I think, 32 incumbents who were running under their party banner, and the incumbent turnover rate has actually been quite low in the past two elections in Solomon Islands. So 2014 and 2019, you had incumbent turnover rates of 28% in 2019, 26% in 2014. So the majority of incumbents were retaining their seats. If that pattern had held, you probably would have seen quite a large block of OUR, of our party candidates, winning seats in the 2024 election. But as it happened, a lot of their incumbents lost. They won 15 seats out of 50. So while they were the largest block going into these negotiations, they were very short of that 26 seats that would constitute a majority. So they did have to negotiate with other parties, with independent MPs, to form government. And we saw in those negotiations, Tsogavare is still part of that government bloc, but he's not the prime minister anymore.
And are there particular kind of political divides or ethnic cleavages or anything that kind of distinguish that governing bloc from, you know, the opposition? I know Matthew Wale, who's the kind of leader of the opposition bloc. Are there any big dividing lines there?
Not that we can really see looking at the election results all over the country. You have our party winning seats all over. You have independent candidates winning seats all over. The opposition bloc also picking up seats in various parts of the country. So we don't see any kind of clear geographic divisions. And that's not surprising because a lot of campaigning, electioneering in Solomon Islands is very localized. So we're not talking about party platforms or national political issues necessarily. It's very much focused on the local. And so each kind of individual MP, whether they're a party candidate or not, is campaigning on the basis of their own individual platform. And then the party affiliations and those dynamics really just come into play after the election.
I know that one of your big focuses has been around representation of women in the Pacific. What do the stats look like about women running and getting elected, getting re-elected at this election?
So it is actually pretty similar to PNG and other Pacific parliaments in that women's representation has historically been very low in Solomon Islands. In the last parliament, you had four women MPs out of 50, so 8%. This election, we saw three women candidates win, which is really a better result than a lot of people expected. It's still under what it was in the last parliament, but actually two of those women in the last parliament came in through by-elections. On election night in 2019, actually only two women were elected. So there is an increase in terms of election results for 2024. One of those women has been re-elected, Frida Tuki Soriakumua, who has been in parliament since 2014. And two, Choylan Douglas in Central Province and Kathy Norrie in Isabel Province. They are newest parliamentarians, but they have contested before. Both of them came second in 2019. Kathy Norrie also contested 2014 and came third. So they've been around in the election context for a while, but have gotten into parliament this time. So also no kind of clear divide in terms of party affiliation. Frieda Tuki was an Our Party candidate. Choylan Douglason and Kathy Norrie were independent candidates. So yeah, a range of different women in different parts of the country. Still not a lot. That's 6% of parliament. So still very underrepresented, obviously, relative to the number of women voters and citizens, but still quite a good result given there have been times in Solomon Islands history where there have been no women in parliament at all.
Even though in theory the single member system looks a lot similar to what we might have in Australia, it seems like there's a bit of differences with how it works. In Australia, where we've taken for granted the concept of a secret ballot, but like what have they had to do in the Solomon Islands to ensure the ballots are secret, and how effective is it?
In terms of the way the election is run, there is a secret ballot. There are measures in place so that people should be able to vote in private. Their ballot paper is not linked in any way to their voter ID. And then even in the counting process, instead of counting box by box, boxes are actually combined into what's called batches. So the idea behind that is that no one should be able to link a ballot even to the polling station where it was cast, let alone to the voter who cast it. So there have been all these measures in place to try and strengthen the idea of the secret ballot in Solomon Islands, but it really hasn't been institutionalized in a meaningful sense. A lot of voters do believe that it is possible for MPs to find out who voted for them. And more than that, a lot of voters actively want their MP to know that they voted for them because they see that as a way to get access to constituency development funds, which is a proportion of the government budget that's set aside for MPs to spend in a discretional sense in their constituencies. For voters, it's not even that there's a fear of people being able to find out who they voted for. Often there's an incentive for them to be able to say to their MP, no, I voted for you. I think there is a secret ballot in a formal sense, but in terms of the political norms around the secret ballot, it really isn't institutionalized fully in Solomon Islands.
What's your sense of the state of election integrity in the Solomon Islands? Like, to compare it to the neighbour in Papua New Guinea, where there's often a lot of violence, a lot of issues with ballot boxes being destroyed and things like that. And it's generally considered to be free, but maybe not always fair. How would you rate the elections in the Solomon Islands in terms of integrity?
I think in terms of electoral administration, the processes are quite strong in Solomon Islands, and you certainly see a lot of community buy-in. In Solomon Islands, there isn't the hijacking of ballot boxes that you might see elsewhere. There is a fear of violence, though. And that was certainly the case in this election. But the trigger for violence is seen as in that government formation period. So the election of prime minister has often been the flashpoint for violence, for riots in past elections. And so it's at that point that security issues really come into play. In 2024, we haven't seen that. When the current government was formed last week, we didn't see riots or widespread violence, but I guess we still haven't kind of had the swearing of ministers yet, and there still is kind of potential for election-related violence because there has been election-related violence in the past in Solomon Islands, and that was certainly a concern on the ground this year as well, although it hasn't come to pass yet.
And I know that there's a history of a lot of petitions challenging someone's successful election. Where are we up to with that? Like, is there a lot of that going on at the moment?
So the petition period is open at the moment, and you would normally expect in Solomon Islands elections to see quite a few petitions coming in. In 2019, there were petitions filed in 28 out of the 50 constituencies, so more than half had a petition filed, and then a small subset of that, those petitions were successful and there were by-elections held for those seats. So based on past experience, we can expect to see a few of these results being litigated in court over the next year or so. There is one seat in particular where there have already been indications that that result will go to court, and that's the seat of Galba Gotu in Isabel Province. This seat had a very, very narrow margin. The winning candidate won by 13 votes. And in this province, there was also an oversight in the counting process where pre-poll ballots weren't included in the count. So the only people allowed to pre-poll in Solomon Islands are election officials or security officials. So the number of pre-poll ballots is very low. In Galbagoto, it's actually 13 pre-poll ballots that are uncounted. And so because that's the exact margin that the winning candidate won by, there is the potential that those votes could have changed the result. So that's something that we might expect to see go to court. It's a bit unclear about where to go from there in terms of that result. But more generally, IQ would usually expect to see some contestation around the election results going through the courts in the next year or so.
When we were talking beforehand, you were also explaining that there's a lot of interesting dynamics around where people register to vote. You know, you've got these 50 constituencies, but they're not always strictly about where someone lives, and there's often a bit of movement. So tell us a bit about this kind of registration across borders that you get.
So one dynamic that's becoming increasingly clear in Solomon Islands election is the movement of voters from one constituency to another during the registration period. We can see in 2024 those dynamics really clearly. Overall, the increase to the voter roll was 17% nationally, which makes sense in terms of the population increase in the past 5 years. But within individual constituencies, you see these really dramatic differences in how much the voter roll has increased, or in some cases, it's also decreased. The largest increase in 2024 was Northeast Guadalcanal, where the roll increased by 60%. And then numbers of voters have decreased by up to 16% in places like Baigu Asafola in Malaita. So these patterns are interesting, and they do seem to be driven both by candidates, but also by enterprising voter blocs who are, you know, maybe not seeing as much potential to make a difference in one constituency. So they move to another to be able to play a more pivotal role in the election result. Now, it's important to note that this isn't necessarily illegal. There are provisions in the electoral law that allow people to register where they don't necessarily live, but they have some kind of family or other affinity to. And that facilitates a lot of this movement. And so it means that a key part of campaigning for candidates is not just, you know, convincing people in those communities to vote for you. It's moving people from elsewhere in the country to register to vote in those communities so that they're able to support you. It's certainly become a really critical part of a successful election campaign. It also means that the already established inequities in terms of boundary distribution in Solomon Islands are being exacerbated, I guess, by this cross-border registration issue. We already have quite a vast difference between the largest constituencies and the smallest constituencies. The largest constituency in Solomon Islands is about five times as big as the smallest in terms of the number of registered voters. And so a vote doesn't carry equal weight across Solomon Islands. It really depends on where you're voting. And when registration can increase by more than 50% from election to election, then that also really, really dramatically affects the value of an individual vote from place to place.
Is there much of a trend of urbanisation of people moving to Honiara or any other cities as well? Because I know that's often a factor with that, particularly if you're not redrawing the electoral map, that a growing city relative to the rural areas around it can kind of affect that balance. But also if people maintain links to their former communities where they used to live, that's also an interesting factor where they maybe don't identify as being a voter from the capital.
Yeah, there are really high rates of urbanisation in Solomon Islands, and there's three constituencies in Honiara. They are some of the biggest in the country, so which leads to what has been described by some scholars as a rural gerrymander. Actually, votes are more valuable in rural areas than they are in urban areas. There's not a huge push to change this, not just because most MPs are from rural areas because of that gerrymander, so there's no real pressure to change it. But also because a lot of people who are ordinarily resident in Honiara don't choose to register to vote there. In the days leading up to polling day in Honiara, the streets get eerily quiet. You have these normally very, very intense traffic jams in the mornings and in the evenings in downtown Honiara. They don't exist in the days before polling day and the days after, because so many people have left the capital. They've travelled back to other communities to cast their votes. And so even for urban residents, the underrepresentation of urban interests in parliament is not necessarily a really key priority, because they see their political interests as lying elsewhere.
Are there any big issues that dominated the campaign? I know from the Australian perspective, the Solomon Islands has been relevant in terms of its relationship with China. And I know that's probably a source of interest from Australia, but in terms of how people are voting or the issues that are being talked about in the coalition formations, like, is there anything particular that's jumping out?
These kind of national issues and particularly foreign policy issues don't necessarily come into play in a huge way in terms of voter choices. You could, I think, say with some confidence that the issue of Solomon Islands was probably a bigger part of the last Australian election than the issue of Australia was in terms of the most recent Solomon Islands election, because it's just not necessarily a key factor in voters' minds. Certainly, the issue of relationships with new and more traditional partners is something that governments in Solomon Islands have to deal with very carefully. And those negotiations around the formation of government are very opaque. It's really hard to say what goes on in terms of that coalition building, and certainly a foreign policy might be a part of that. But in terms of the issues that candidates are campaigning on, they're very local and they're not necessarily particularly preoccupied with Solomon Islands' place in the world. So this was the first election that was held jointly with provincial and Honiara City Council elections. So voters had two ballot papers to fill out rather than one. The idea being that, I guess, at least in theory, it would be easier for voters to just vote the one time, and it would increase the rates of participation for provincial elections. I wouldn't say it had a huge impact on turnout, but we are seeing some kind of interesting dynamics with the formation of the provincial governments as well as the formation of the national government. Certainly the most high-profile critic of Sogavare for international audiences, Daniel Suidani, he wasn't contesting the national level. He was contesting one of the provincial seats in Miletus. So those provincial to national dynamics are potentially quite interesting. We're still seeing the process of provincial government formation happening at the moment. It's not solidified yet. Very low rates of women being elected at the provincial assemblies, which is perhaps a concern for some. And there has been a proposal for reserve seats for women in the provincial assemblies that might come to pass in this term of government.
So that's about it for this episode of the Tally Room podcast. Thank you, Karen, for joining me.
Thanks.
You can find this podcast on your podcast app of choice. If you like the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on iTunes. You can follow the Tally Room on Mastodon at tallyroom@mastodon.au or like us on Facebook. This podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support of donors on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tallyroom. Information about this podcast is available at tallyroom.com.au, and you can email questions or feedback to thetallyroom@gmail.com. Thanks to Krista Bro for writing the music here in this episode. Once again, thanks for listening.